You're listening to Shameless Potpourri with Joe Heschmeyer, a production of Catholic Answers.
Welcome back to Shameless Potpourri. I'm Joe Heschmeyer. So over the next several weeks, I want to look at five arguments against atheism and for the existence of a divine creator based on the theology and philosophy, the arguments made by Joseph Ratzinger / Benedict XVI. Now, if you know anything about Benedict, you know that over the course of his decades as a public intellectual, theologian, university professor, priest, bishop, cardinal, pope, pope emeritus, he made a lot more than five arguments. I have chosen five for a pretty simple reason. It's in honor of St. Thomas Aquinas's five ways, the Quinque Vie, from the Summa Theologiae, that Aquinas really famously has five arguments that are intellectually solid for showing the existence of God. Aquinas doesn't claim these are the only five. They're just five that he chooses. Likewise, I've just chosen five for Benedict based on his decades worth of writing. The first three are really intellectual arguments. The last two are arguments of the heart. I'm only going to look at the first one this week. We'll get into the second one next week and so on. All of this, by the way, is adapted from a talk I gave in September 2023, the Catholic Answers Conference, where I looked at all five of these, but only had like 40, 45 minutes to do all five. So I like being able to kind of expand on these. So at some point, that talk will be online. I don't think it is right now. I don't really have any control over that. But I want to take the opportunity to flesh out each of these arguments and show why I think it's intellectually strong and why I think it works. And in each of these, Benedict is responding or interacting in some way with some other great thinker, sometimes intentionally and explicitly. Other times, I'm going to make the kind of connection for him. But like this week, for instance, on the argument from science and intelligibility, he's going to deal with the theology of Albert Einstein, which I don't know a lot of people who've done work in this area, but Einstein's theology is rooted in his scientific vision of the world. And Einstein, more than most people, I think, makes a really compelling case for why science requires something like religion to be true, and why a religious kind of vision of reality is the impulse behind all the great scientists. That's a remarkable claim. I would not have been able to make that because I don't have the scientific standing. Einstein does, and I want to explore kind of the arguments that he makes. Then next week, when we look at the meaning of life, Ratzinger is going to take seriously the atheism of the 19th century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, you know, the famous God is dead guy. Then the week after that, we're going to look at existence itself and kind of ask the same question the philosopher Martin Heidegger asks about why does anything exist at all? And then we'll turn from the really heady stuff to two arguments that are much more, I think, viscerally true that Ratzinger actually thought were his favorite arguments for the existence of God. The existence of beauty and the existence of saints. And on beauty, he sounds like no one so much as Edgar Allan Poe. And on saints, I want to look at actual saints like Mother Teresa to see his argument in action. So bear with me over the next couple of weeks if you want to follow this, because these are going to be, like I said, the headier arguments first, and then the ones that are more intuitive, viscerally true arguments of the heart kind of after that. In posing these, I want to begin by asking the question, okay, but do any of these five ways prove the existence of the Christian God? Because there's sometimes this perceived chasm between, you know, the God of the philosophers and the God of the Bible. And so anytime you make an intellectual argument, you'll have people say, oh yeah, but that doesn't prove the God of the Bible. And in one sense, that's perfectly true. But I think we want to be cautious, because a lot of times people have the idea that to be religious, you just irrationally believe. Miracle on 34th Street, the old Christmas movie, has a terrible line, like, faith is believing when common sense tells you not to. And Mark Twain quotes a schoolboy as saying, faith is believing what you know ain't so. Those are terrible understandings of faith. Instead, faith goes beyond reason, but is rooted in reason. And so Aquinas, he's going to put it like this. Like I said, he's got these five ways for showing the existence of God, but he's not trying to prove all of the claims of the Bible. Instead, he's doing something much more basic. He says that the existence of God and other truths about God that are knowable from natural reason are not articles of faith. These are not things you have to have the gift of faith to believe. These are preambles to the articles. That even if you don't trust God at all, even if you have no faith, you can still see from the created world that it is created and therefore has a creator. That kind of idea. Whether you love God or hate him, you can know from reason alone that he exists. And so faith presupposes natural knowledge, just as grace builds upon nature. That's his argument. And this is very much the way the Bible understands this as well. The Bible is not just saying irrationally believe contrary to common sense, contrary to everything you believe. No, it's simply not true. There are two kinds of knowledge claims made in the Bible. First, there are those things that we can only know from God revealing them. These are what are called special revelation. And so St. Paul, for instance, in 1 Corinthians, he quotes Isaiah as saying that what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man conceived, God has prepared for those who love him. But there are some things, like the existence of heaven and what it's like, that you're not going to be able to reason to. There's no lab experiment you're going to do to get to a claim like that. That's something you simply have to trust God when he tells you about those things. Those are the objects of faith. Those are articles of faith. But those aren't the only parts of the Christian worldview. So St. Paul also points out in Romans 1 that what can be known about God is plain to them. He means here the pagans, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible nature, his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. In other words, just from the existence of created reality, you can know some things about God. Not everything, but some things. That's the idea, that there are some things that are the object of reason, and there are some things that are the object of faith. And the existence of God, the fact that a God exists, is not a question of faith, but is a question of reason alone. Who that God is, what he's like, whether we can trust him, that's when you start to go into the realm of faith. But prior to that, we are in the realm of knowledge. Let me give a kind of macabre example that I think might illustrate this well. Imagine for a second that you're a coroner and someone brings in a body, say Mrs. Smith. Your job as a coroner is to figure out, did she die of natural causes or did a person do this to her? You know, was she a murder victim? You're not the judge and jury. You're not the detective. You don't have to say who did it. You don't have to say it was Mr. Smith. You don't have to say why Mr. Smith did it. None of that. Your job is much more basic. Was this natural and impersonal, or is this the result of some personal, in this case, attack? Well, likewise, when we're asking these questions about the universe, we're asking a very similar question. Is the universe here as a result of merely impersonal forces, just an accident of nature? Or is the universe here as a result of personal agency? Was there a mind behind the universe? That's your question, natural causes or personal. You don't have to say at this point, what's that person like? What's the divine intelligence like? Do I trust him? Do I like him? Which religion accurately describes him, if any? That's not the question yet. The question is much more simple than that. Personal or impersonal. And so that's what we're trying to do. In Ratzinger's words, we're looking to whether or not there is a creative logos behind the universe. Now, logos is a Greek word, and Ratzinger is going to point to the beginning of the Gospel of John, which begins in the beginning. Now, in the beginning is also how Genesis begins, but John has a twist where he starts with the words of Genesis and then says, in the beginning was the logos. Now, logos is a term from Greek philosophy, and it's a word that means both reason and word. So he's saying, yes, there is a God in the beginning, and this God is not just any God, he's logos. He is a creative intelligence. In Ratzinger's words, a reason which is creative and capable of self-communication precisely as reason. That tells us what kind of God. We haven't gotten to all of the who, as to who God is. We can say that God is, and we can say a little bit about what kind of God had to have created the universe. That's the claim. So it's more than just the universe was created, but less than every claim in the Bible is true. So we're we're honing in, but we're not there yet. That's all we're trying to do. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos is God. That there is a creative intellect behind the existence of the universe. So with that, let's turn to the first of the five arguments, the only one we're going to get to this week. The argument from science and intelligibility. What can we learn from Benedict XVI, then Father Ratzinger, and Albert Einstein? In 1968, Father Joseph Ratzinger, in a book called Introduction to Christianity, makes the argument. He says there really is such a thing as the reference of the universe to its creator. In other words, the universe points to the existence of God. And he says we can rebel against the proof of the existence of God. We can raise philosophical objections, even valid ones, to the individual steps in the argument. In other words, a Christian might present an argument for the existence of God that you can logically say, yeah, that argument's not airtight. Fine, great. But nevertheless, he says, the fact remains that the radiance of the original creative idea and its power to build shimmers through the world in its intelligible structure. That you, as much as you can quibble about the steps in a syllogism, as much as you can question any of the particular proofs, there is something inescapable about the intelligible nature of the universe itself. It shines through, it shimmers through, and is kind of unavoidable. That's a profound claim, I think. And to back it up, he cites to Albert Einstein, the great scientist. And Einstein has an essay entitled Science and Religion. He actually explores this theme several times. There's actually, I think, multiple essays by that name by Einstein. But in one of them, he makes a claim. You will hardly find one among the profounder sort of scientific minds without a peculiar religious feeling of his own. I want to just point that out. That's a big claim. He's saying there are barely any atheist scientists who are any good. That's a bold kind of claim, I think. Nevertheless, he says it is a different kind of religion, religious feeling, than the religion of what he calls the naive man. So what is a scientist's religion like? His religious feeling takes the form of a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which Einstein says reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic thinking and acting of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. That's his claim. I think it's a really incredible kind of claim that we can know from natural law. He doesn't mean here what a philosopher means by natural law. He means things like the scientific laws. You've got like the four fundamental forces, all of this stuff, the mathematical coherence of the universe, that from that we can know that the universe was created by an intelligence of such superiority that we are just a dim echo. That's his claim. It's a pretty astonishing one. And in fact, he claims that this religious vision or impulse is the guiding principle of the great scientist's life and work, and that it's beyond question closely akin to that which has possessed religious geniuses of all ages. That if you look at the great mystics and you look at the great scientists, they actually have a very similar vision of reality. That's Einstein's claim, and it's, I think, a really interesting kind of argument. And he points out that, you know, many of us are acquainted with science chiefly in its practical results. You know, you've got the latest, greatest iPhone. You've got an airplane. You've got the atom bomb. You've got whatever. And so your knowledge of science is it produced some stuff, or, you know, they discovered a new planet, or they, you know, found a new species. And if that's your understanding of science, you can have a completely false notion of the mentality of the men who, surrounded by a skeptical world, have shown the way to kindred spirits scattered wide through the world and through the centuries. In other words, I look to somebody like Bill Nye, the Science Guy. He's got an associate's degree in science. He has very little actual understanding of science. And as a result, he's utterly dismissive of philosophy and utterly dismissive of religion. And he has what Einstein calls a completely false notion of the mentality of an actual man of science. And so instead, Einstein claims that only one who's really devoted themselves to science can have the vivid realization of what has inspired these men and given them the strength to remain true to their purpose in spite of countless failures. And what is it that inspires them? According to Einstein, it is cosmic religious feeling that gives a man such strength. And then he quotes a contemporary, he doesn't say which one, who says that in this materialistic age of ours, the serious scientific workers are the only profoundly religious people. So in response to the claim, you know, can a scientist be religious? Einstein's argument is only a scientist is really religious these days, because only a scientist realizes how insane, how incredible this world is, how obviously marked by intelligibility. And the scientist is driven by this religious conviction to do science. That you have to be a fervent believer in the intelligibility of the universe, of it being created by an intelligence, or else you have no business trying to do science in the first place. Or like, if the universe isn't created by an intelligence, then there's no reason to expect it to be intelligent. Think about it this way. You've got someone who spends their entire life trying to understand the theme of a particular book. They have to be really convinced of the intelligence of the author. Because if the author isn't intelligent, if it's a really idiotic author, or worse, not an author at all, just, you know, randomly generated text, or, you know, ink spilled on a page, you're not going to find any intelligibility there. You're not going to find any pattern or be able to build any kind of theory about what's going on in the work if there's nothing going on in the work. And so the scientist has to be completely persuaded of the intelligibility of the universe to be able to do science. This is the cosmic religious feeling that Einstein talks about. Bishop Barron takes Ratzinger and Einstein's argument. He puts it like this. He says the universal intelligibility of nature, which is the presupposition of all science, can only be explained through recourse to an infinite and creative mind, which has thought the world into being. That's what both Ratzinger and Einstein are claiming here. That science presupposes the kind of universe you would only get if a divine intelligence had created the world. So to put that as kind of a logical syllogism, we would say the first premise, if a divine intelligence did not create the universe, then the universe would not be or is not intelligible, right? Like if there's no divine intelligence, there's no intelligibility. And intelligibility is the product of intelligence. So if there's no divine mind behind the universe, there's no intelligibility to the universe. That's the first argument. The second premise, the universe is in fact intelligible. This is, again, what science presupposes. The conclusion, therefore, is that a divine intelligence did create the universe. Again, we're not yet to, do I love this divine intelligence? Does he love me? Did he send his son into the world? We're not, none of those questions yet. But just this much more basic thing, that the universe is the result of divine agency and intelligibility is the result of intelligence. So when I talk about intelligibility, or when any of the authors I'm citing here talk about intelligibility, what do we mean by that idea? Intelligibility can be understood in two ways. And so think here again of a book. If you're going to be like an English literature scholar and you're going to focus on, I don't know, Beowulf, Shakespeare, whatever, two things have to be true. Number one, the work that you're focusing on, the book, has to be legible. It has to be actually the result of some kind of intelligent mind creating legibility. It could be artificial intelligence, maybe, sure. But something like intelligence has to have produced a legible book. And second, you have to be literate. Those two things both have to be true, or else you don't have any kind of intelligibility. You need to have a book that is legible, and you have to be literate. So if you have animals scratching on a cave wall, that is not legible. There's no intelligence behind it. It's just chaotic. And so you're not going to be able to make heads or tails out of it, even if you can read. On the other hand, you could have a beautifully written book, but in a language that you don't read, and you're not literate. So you need those two things. That's true of reading a book, any written book, whether you're a scholar or just like an ordinary reader. Well, a scientist has an equivalent thing. First, the universe has to be legible. The universe has to make sense at a base level. Now, it doesn't mean you understand everything, right? Like you can read a book without understanding everything the author is doing, but there has to be a base level legibility to the universe. There might be some words you don't understand. There might be some philosophical concepts. There might be some scientific things we don't get right now. That's not the question. There's a base level legibility. And second, we have to have minds capable of knowing the nature of being, of reality, of science. If you didn't have that kind of mind, you couldn't do science. Like a chimpanzee can't do science. They can't have a vision of physics because they just don't have the intellect for it. So those two things have to be true. We have to live in a world that is marked through and through by intelligibility, and an intelligibility discernible in at least its basic form to us. So here's what that argument is not saying. And I want to make this really clear. It's not saying the book is really good, right? Like, I don't have to love Beowulf to realize Beowulf has an author. I don't have to really appreciate all the subtleties of Shakespeare. There may be 90% of it lost on me, and I can still make out enough of it to realize that the thing makes sense, that there's a problem on my end in understanding it, not a problem on the other end in terms of making a legible work. Well, likewise with the universe, we don't have to say we understand the nature of all of reality. There can still be things we don't understand. Scientifically, there can still be all sorts of things we don't understand, like why does suffering exist in the way that it does? The argument here does not presuppose that we have or need to have all of the answers. We just need to have enough to know this thing is legible. Moreover, I don't have to like it. I don't have to love the universe. I don't have to think it's the best of all possible worlds. I don't have to admire the work God did in the universe. This is not an argument about any of those things. This is not an argument for fine tuning. This is not an argument from beauty. This is, right now, it is just a question that, love it or hate it, the universe is marked by intelligibility. Even if you understand only a teeny tiny bit of it, there's an intelligible structure to the universe that lets you understand even that much. That's the claim. It's a lower bar, but it's an important thing to make sure we get right. So that's the argument in a nutshell. And I was curious, like, well, what would non-believers, what would an atheist say to that argument? And I haven't found any really high-level engagement with this argument by atheist philosophers or writers. If you know of any, please drop it in the comments below. I'd love to actually see more critical engagement. The best I was able to find was actually a subreddit on debating religion from like 7 years ago, where someone threw out Ratzinger's argument. And the arguments in response were overwhelmingly criticizing what I've got as the second premise, the intelligibility of the universe. And so, you know, the claim that physics, chemistry, psychology, astronomy, biology, and so forth rest on the assumption of the knowability of being, which they do, was denied by several atheists who said, no, science doesn't rest on that. There's no commitment to objective intelligibility in any of the sciences. And at least one person threw out, well, maybe if Ratzinger spent some time looking into quantum physics, he would not be too quick to declare the universe is marked with intelligibility. And I really appreciated that, because if this person knew a little more about quantum physics, they'd realize what a bad argument that is. So remember that kind of Bill Nye claim that, you know, a much more atheistic worldview if you don't really understand scientists. Well, this is also true if you don't really understand quantum physics. For those of us who are not quantum physicists, and I'm in that number, quantum physics can seem like a total intellectual Wild West where anything can happen. You know, particles over here and then it's over there and there's no rhyme or reason. It just is total chaos. That's the kind of popular understanding of quantum physics. That is not a very good understanding of quantum physics. There's much more regularity, much more order, even in the world of quantum physics. And one of the reasons I say that is a 1960 essay by Eugene Wigner, one of the fathers of quantum mechanics, who explains the shocking thing about quantum physics isn't how insane and out of control it is. The shocking thing about it is how mathematically ordered the whole thing is, even when it seems like it's completely going off the rails. Now, I'm largely paraphrasing there. Wigner's essay is entitled The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. And I love the way he words that, the unreasonable effectiveness, because he's making two claims. One, mathematics works really well in natural sciences like physics. And number two, there's no reason why mathematics works. So in other words, we can see that math works in all these other areas, But if you ask a scientist, why does math work here? There is no scientific answer to that question. And so Wigner in his essay looks at three questions. What is mathematics anyway? And then what is physics? And then the third question he doesn't ask explicitly, but it's very much the theme of the entire essay. Why is mathematics so unreasonably effective in physics? Now, he begins the essay by recounting a really like nerdy scientific joke. And I'm going to do my best to kind of explain the joke with the proviso that it's not funny, but it is really helpful in kind of explaining what he's talking about. So in the joke, you've got two friends who are friends from high school, and one of them has gone on to become a statistician. And so they're, you know, at their high school reunion or whatever. And the non-scientist friend is asking his scientist statistician friend, what's stats all about? Like, what do you do in statistics? And so the statistician is showing some essays and showing some like academic research on Gaussian distributions. Now, if you're familiar with the idea of a bell curve, you know, if you've got something like average blood pressure in Massachusetts, say, you're going to have most people clustered around something like the middle with a few people at the really upper end and a few people at the really lower end, whatever it is. And this is across the field, whatever area of kind of human endeavor you're looking at, whether it's something natural or whether it's something man-made, you're going to find these bell curves all over the place. But the simple-looking bell curve is actually the result of what's called a Gaussian distribution, which is a complicated mathematical formula. So in the joke, the stats guy is explaining this to the non-stats guy. And the non-stats guy is not entirely sure if his friend is just messing with him. Because like, what do any of these things have to do with each other? Why do we find these bell curves all over the place? And so he's showing the formula. And the non-statistician looks at the Gaussian distribution and he sees a symbol he doesn't recognize. And he points to it and he goes, well, what is that? And the statistician says, oh, well, glad you asked. That's pi. It's the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. And the non-stats nerd says, now you've pushed the joke too far. Because what would the relationship of a circumference to a diameter possibly have to do with these other areas of human endeavor? In other words, like, why would average blood pressure have anything to do with circle geometry? And that's the joke. And it's, as I said, not a funny joke. Because we're supposed to just kind of laugh at the guy who's like completely not getting that pi is this kind of concept. But here's the thing. Eugene Wigner hears a joke and he has what he describes as an eerie feeling because he realizes the non-statistician is right. Why should pi show up in all of these seemingly unrelated areas? Why should it be such an effective force for making sense of reality? Now, Wigner is neither the first nor the last person to have this kind of startling realization and to pose the question. More recently, the astrophysicist Mario Livio in his book, Is God a Mathematician? Asks this question as well. And he puts it like this. He says, mathematics appears to be almost too effective in describing and explaining not only the cosmos at large, but even some of the most chaotic of human enterprises. And Livio gives several examples. He goes, okay, you got physicians who are attempting to formulate theories of the universe. You've got stock market analysts who are trying to predict the next market crash. You've got neurobiologists who are making models of brain function. You've got military intelligence statisticians who are trying to optimize resource allocation, and they're all using mathematics. Like, in other words, there's one conceptual numeric linguistic framework that can accurately help predict all of these apparently unrelated fields of inquiry. Everything from making sense of the cosmos to the stock market to neurology to the next war is using this same framework of mathematics. And we take that absolutely for granted. As non-mathematicians, we just are like, yeah, of course it does. But a mathematician is saying, why? Just as this guy in the joke saying, why should we find pi in all of these different areas? Why do we find number in all of these different areas? And why is it predictable? Why is it able to do all of these things? So I want to return now to Eugene Wigner in his work on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. is he quotes Schrodinger. You may be familiar with Schrodinger's cat, the thought experiment, also in quantum physics. And he says, it is, as Schrodinger has remarked, a miracle that in spite of the baffling complexity of the world, certain regularities in the events could be discovered. In other words, you know, we look at quantum physics and we see the baffling complexity. We think, aha, there must not be any rules. But no, baffling complexity doesn't mean lawless chaos. Because underneath all of this baffling complexity, we find certain regularities, what Wigner is going to call invariance principles. And he gives the example, for instance, the law of gravity. That, you know, Galileo realizes that if you drop two rocks at the same time from the same height, they reach the ground at the same time. This is true whether it's the 16th century, the 21st century, the first century, the 31st century. It's true whether it's in Italy or the US or on the moon. Now, there are certain factors that play in, things like air resistance and the like. But the idea that, you know, at sea level, things proceed towards the ground 9.81 meters over second squared, that's the invariance principle. And the laws of nature, Wigner says, are concerned with such regularities. Now, you might just take that for granted, but you have to understand this has to exist in order for something like physics to work. You can't just have everything be a variable. You need some things that are invariable, things that remain constant. So, like, think about a science experiment. If you're comparing two things, you need a control and a variable. Because if everything is constantly in motion, you don't know what causes what. You need some things that are stable that you can then test the things that are variable against. Oh, I hope that makes sense. That's true whether you're doing something like, you know, testing a new clinical research drug. You keep both people's diets the same, everything else they're doing the same, so you have as much invariability as possible. Then you have the one, you know, one of them's on the drug and one of them's not. That's the variability. Then you can isolate the variables, you can test it. Well, this is true in something like physics as well. You need invariance, things like the really predictable things like gravity. And if you have the invariance, you can then try to make sense of the variables, the things that seem to change and move and all the rest. But you need to have the invariance where you can't do anything else. Because in the if everything is constantly in motion, if everything is constantly changing, there's no way to isolate variables, there's no way to test what causes what and the rest. So Wigner explains, in his words, the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. That's at the heart of this claim. You've got all these, you know, smug internet atheists saying if Ratzinger only knew about quantum physics, he wouldn't say any of this stuff is true. And the quantum physicists are saying, you don't understand. It's a miracle any of this works. Literally a miracle. This is not, here's a formula that explains why math works in physics. No. To have physics, you need math to work in physics first. You can't arrive at that conclusion. You have to start from that kind of about the nature of reality. And so Wigner says we should be grateful for this miracle, right? And we should hope it remains valid. We've got no reason it's valid right now. So there's no reason to know if math will work tomorrow, but thank God it does, right? And hopefully it works in other areas as well. That's what he comes to. It's a position of astonishing intellectual humility, of realizing that the world makes sense and we don't know why it makes sense. So that's Wigner. Going back to Mario Livio, the astrophysicist. He describes it as the apparent omnipresence and omnipotent powers of mathematics. You got all these different areas where math works, and we can't say why it works, but it does, and thank God that it does. And so he quotes the British physicist James Sheens from 1877 to 1946, who once said, the universe appears to have been designed by a pure mathematician. Now, this is not new to Mario Livio or Eugene Wigner or Schrodinger or James Sheens. This is going to be something we find for millennia. But before I get there, Livio has a really helpful quote from who else? Albert Einstein, who asks, how is it possible that mathematics, a product of human thought that is independent of experience, fits so excellently the objects of physical reality? This is at the heart of it, and I want to make sure as best I can, I kind of explain why this is so mind-blowing. Because when you look at something like pi, it isn't that the concept of pi is first formulated in the field, that they're doing all this stats research and they form, you know, they put together all the bar charts and then they say what mathematical model could make sense of this, and then they discover pi. No. Something like pi is formed from a purely abstract concept of a perfect circle. We're looking at the radius and the circumference and the area and all of this. You're looking at the ratio of the circumference of the circle to, I believe, the diameter. And so you're dealing with this perfect circle that doesn't even exist in your reality. It's just an intellectual kind of concept. And from this, you're getting this ratio, pi, that it so happens we find all over the place in real life. That's really helpful for doing things like stats work. It's really helpful for doing things like physics. It's really helpful for actual things out in the world. But this thing that was kind of this intellectual experiment in a purely abstract sort of way ends up working in real life. It's hard to overstate how surprising that is. Be like, this isn't a great example. But imagine you said, I think the perfect movie would be one in which it had the following plot elements and had all of this and all of that. And you're not going off of anything you've actually seen. You're just imagining, like, based on human relations, what would be the best possible movie? And then you open the newspaper and lo and behold, that movie is showing in the theaters. I think you would be kind of creeped out. I think you would be really alarmed and say, well, why is it that this thing that was independent of experience, I didn't know this movie was in the works, why should it so excellently correspond to this really existing thing? Well, that's the question Einstein's asking. You've got these mathematical kind of intellectual queries that are being made that sometimes years or centuries later turn out to be really effective in the real world in these ways that are unpredictable and weren't predicted even by the people pioneering the math in this area. And that is really strange and alarming and points to the intelligibility of the universe. So Reisinger, as kind of like round this back, he makes the point that Pythagoras had a similar kind of insight. Now, the Pythagorean theorem, right? We're now going back even before the time of Christ. This is not, you don't have to be a quantum physicist to realize the intelligibility and the coherence of the universe. You just have to be someone who pays attention to the math and how it interacts in real life. That there's a Pythagorean saying about the God who practices geometry. Before we saw all this in physics, we saw it in geometry, that these geometric concepts seem to show up in real life. And so Reisinger says that in this Pythagorean saying, there is expressed the insight into the mathematical structure of being, which learns to understand being as having been thought, as intellectually structured. In other words, the fact that you can kind of have a musing about geometry in an abstract sense and then you see it in real life points to the fact that reality is intelligible. It is structured. It is mathematical. This is, you know, James, you know, God's a mathematician. Pythagoras, he's a geometer. All of that is pointing to something about the fact that there is this superior intelligence revealed in the universe. So in closing, the argument in a nutshell again, first premise, if there was no divine intelligence creating the universe, there would be no intelligibility in the universe. If there's no author, there's no authored work, right? You wouldn't have intelligibility without God. It doesn't make sense for it to just be there. This is why it's spoken of even by scientists in this language of it being a miracle, of it being this cosmic religious feeling. All of that is pointing to this first premise. The second premise, the universe is in fact intelligible. If it weren't, you couldn't do science. And I cannot stress that enough. And therefore we can conclude a divine intelligence created the universe. Now, I want to stress here that the argument's actually a little stronger even than I've put it, because as Einstein points out, it's not just that there's an intelligence that created the universe, there's an intelligence that surpasses our own intelligence, right? That, in his words, there's an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic thinking and acting of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. We can show that in a pretty straightforward way. Think about a great work of human intelligence, say the Star Wars trilogy. There are still plot holes. There are still mistakes. There are still imperfections. Or Take something like computer code. There are still bugs. There are still glitches. A beautiful car. There are still things that fall apart that don't quite hang together quite like they should. There's a failure rate in all of these things. Our formulas are imperfect and imprecise. Even something like pi. We've got a lot of pi. We don't have it perfectly. And we never will. In the nature of the thing, we can do a lot, but there's an infinite number of digits. We're never going to get there, definitionally. And so in all of these areas of human ingenuity and human intelligence, there are still these imperfections where we can see both intelligibility and the areas where intelligibility breaks down. But when we get to the intelligibility that we don't invent but discover, that is what we discover through math and science, it doesn't break down. It isn't like gravity doesn't work on Wednesdays, or, you know, there's a bug where in Phoenix things float because gravity wasn't programmed in there. No, there's nothing like that. That we find instead, unlike our intelligence, which produces imperfect intelligibility, this is apparently perfect intelligibility. It is infinitely beyond what we are capable of producing. And you see that again, something like pi. The number of digits we have is still infinitely short of the actual number of digits of pi. That's just one example. And so that's what Einstein means when he says, it's not just that the universe is created by an intelligence. You or I trying to create the universe would not be able to produce anything like what we actually find in the universe. We don't have the brilliance to do it. Einstein didn't have the brilliance to do it. No one in human history, collectively or individually, has the intelligence to do it. Instead, this is an intelligence of such superiority that even the most brilliant minds in history are just a dim reflection. That's the claim Einstein's making. And it's not just some irrational belief. This is just coherently thinking about the mathematical and scientific nature of reality. That things hold together in this way that can't be explained by random chance and can't even be explained by an imperfect lower intelligence like we have, but has to be the result of a superior intelligence like we've never encountered or experienced outside of what we find, right? Like this mind of God that we discover in nature. As I said, that is the first of the five ways. After this, we're going to pivot and move away from Einstein towards Friedrich Nietzsche and look at whether the meaning of life reveals something about the nature of the existence of God. But that'll be for next week. For this week, I would love to hear your feedback. I'd love to hear your thoughts. I mean, this is an argument that I think is really underappreciated, and I'd like to see more people kind of seriously grapple with it, because I think it's really a profoundly powerful point if properly understood. For Seamus Popery, I'm Joe Heschmeyer. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to Shameless Popery, a production of the Catholic Answers Podcast Network. Find more great shows by visiting catholicanswerspodcast.com or search Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.